You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Blue Jays reporter, Gregor Chisholm. And Gregor on the podcast. First of all, it's good to be back with you after about a month away from doing these Extras podcasts because of the postseason and stuff like that. But we're going to get into the offseason, kind of dig into it, what the Blue Jays need to do, what they hope to do. And that all starts with an offseason that's important because of all these free agents. This is a team that's been so successful the last couple of years, obviously getting to the postseason, not getting to the World Series. And now you look at all these guys, nine free agents, including the big two, Encarnacion and Bautista. I think the thought process has kind of been that they'd rather keep Encarnacion if possible, with the chances likely they can't keep both. Do you still get that vibe that he's the guy they'd rather be able to hold on to?
No question about it, although I think the dynamics have changed a little bit since the beginning of the offseason. You know, they made an aggressive attempt to try and sign him early, and you can't blame Encarnacion for wanting to test the market and see where his value goes in the coming weeks. And, I think that's why the Jays made a quick strike to get Morales. But doesn't necessarily completely rule out an Encarnacion return, but it does make it kind of difficult to envision, because if you have Kendrys Morales playing every day a designated hitter, that means that when Encarnacion has to become the everyday first baseman. And he showed that he could do that last season. But I still think there are some long-term question marks there. He's dealt with some back issues, some leg issues in the past. Whether or not those would resurface when playing every day at first base, I think, is the big question mark. But between the two, he's still obviously the big bat that you'd rather have, even over a guy like Jose Bautista, just because, I mean, you look at him right now, he's probably the prime offensive target for most teams out there. And obviously his value speaks for itself and what Edwin Encarnacion has done for the Blue Jays for a very, very long period of time. He's one of the most consistent sluggers in the game and has been for quite a while.
The thing that could really end up stinging, I feel like, with Encarnacion is the fact that if he doesn't end up back in Toronto, there's a decent chance he ends up with a division rival, whether it be the Red Sox or the Yankees, and that would kind of be worst-case scenario, I think. You mentioned Kendrys Morales, 3 years, $33 million for the 33-year-old. Back-to-back solid seasons in Kansas City, 22 homers and a really nice average a couple of years ago, and then 30 home runs in 2016. The average and on base dropped a little bit. He's 33, but you would think for a guy that's going to DH three more years, he should still be fine. I don't think there's any concern about that contract length. And a slugger that can hit 30 home runs this day and age for $11 million a year seems like a pretty solid move.
Yeah, it does seem like a pretty good deal, and especially if the Jays got the sense that they weren't going to be able to retain Edwin Encarnacion, it makes plenty of sense to want to strike early. 3 years at $11 million per for Kendrys Morales is a nice value deal there, and he's put up some strong numbers at Kauffman Stadium in Kansas City, and I think the Blue Jays would, the numbers he's put up there, I think the Jays would be happy if he's able to maintain that, but of course you can always talk about, even the possibility of a potential uptick moving to a hitter-friendly park like Rogers Center, so there's a lot to like there. The one curious part of it is that it does lock in, every day at bats at designated hitters, so it does provide some clues, I think, as to what the Jays' intentions are. But, I think they have so many holes to fill right now. They saw an opportunity to strike early at what they considered to be solid value, and they didn't want to wait around, because I don't think they were confident that if they didn't get a deal done, that 3 year, $33 million for Morales would be enough to get it done, a few weeks from now when the market kind of settles.
You think about other guys that are possible adds to this team, and obviously the outfield is certainly a key. The rumors that you're starting to hear, Josh Reddick, he's a guy who's a free agent. Obviously, Jay Bruce would be available via trade. The Mets will probably not be in a hurry maybe to trade Bruce, depending on how everything else shakes out with Yoenis Cespedes as far as they go. But are there any other guys that you think of on this market that makes sense? I guess the good news for the Blue Jays is this is a market that is light on pitching but is pretty good when it comes to bats.
Yeah, absolutely. And one name I think, I do think it is a long shot, but I think he fits exactly what the Jays need, and it's no surprise. It's a guy like Dexter Fowler. He's the kind of guy who could fit in perfectly with that lineup. And Ross Atkins has been very open about the fact that he wants this team to become a little bit more athletic, a little bit more speedy, and more left-handed hitting as well. And Dexter Fowler kind of checks off all of those boxes. I think that's going to be that would be a difficult move for the Jays to actually try and get in there with serious negotiations. But he's a candidate. Josh Reddick, I think, is one of the main guys to watch here as well, because he kind of fits into that Kendrys Morales mold where you might be able to get him at a relatively affordable deal. He's not someone who's going to require 5 years on term. You might be able to get him on a 3-year deal, and he's someone who's been linked to the Blue Jays for a long time now, back in the Alex Anthopoulos days with the Blue Jays, but then also again this past trade deadline when Atkins was in charge. So there's been a known interest there, and I think that's certainly something that's worth monitoring, because of the fact that Jays also need those corner outfielders, and the left-handed bat in Reddick would fit in nicely as well.
The Jays were quick to sign Morales and also quick to sign Lourdes Gurriel Jr., a 7-year deal, $22 million, and that number sounds like a good discount type price, depending on what happens, although he could end up being into the arbitration system, you never know. But here's a kid, 23 years old, obviously, from Cuba, his older brother signing with the Astros during the season. His older brother was major league ready. It seems like the consensus is that Lourdes Gurriel still needs a little bit of time maybe in the minor leagues. Is that the thought process for the Blue Jays, or could we see him at some point in 2017 in Toronto?
I think for the most part, this is going to be a development year for him. This is a creative way for the Blue Jays to really kind of boost up the upper levels of their minor league system. It's going to take a while for this team to kind of rebuild and overhaul its prospect base, especially when you're trying to contend. That's easier said than done, but this is a way to do it and spend a little money, kind of similar to the way the Blue Jays bought Francisco Liriano and a couple of top prospects from the Pirates at the trade deadline last year. They were able to use money to boost the system then, and they're trying to do it here as well. It's certainly an interesting candidate. He's going to start off, I believe, at shortstop, but I think long-term, most people seem to project him as maybe, a corner infielder or potentially a corner outfielder, and he brings all kinds of athleticism, and it's a high-risk, high-reward type deal, but those are the type of moves you kind of have to make when you're trying to contend while also trying to keep an eye out towards the future as well.
Yeah, and you have to give credit to Ross Atkins and Mark Shapiro, because obviously they got to the system right when a lot of the young talent had been traded away, and most teams would think it's going to take some time to build up that minor league system through the international market and through the draft, but they've been able to, like you said, do it a little bit quicker with some creativity. One more thing as far as the major league roster goes, a 3-year offer for Brett Cecil, is out there, the best thing to say. The biggest question I have about Brett Cecil is, who is the real Brett Cecil? Because it seems like a real Jekyll and Hyde situation where this guy is either absolutely lights out or really bad at times.
Yeah, and to a certain extent, that is Brett Cecil. That's the Brett Cecil we've come to know over the years, because he has that almost every single year. I mean, it was really noticeable last year with the awful start he got onto and he came on strong again in the second half. We saw it the year before that as well, where he didn't allow a single earned run in the second half of the season and, was easily one of the best relievers in the game. And his first half wasn't as bad as it was this year's first half, but it still wasn't that great. So we've seen that up and down from him. And sometimes his, command and velocity will go away and then come back. He's a really tough case to figure out, but when you look at the whole body of work over the last 4 years or so, he really has been a very underrated middle reliever, and the Jays really desperately need to figure that out. And, they need a solid left-handed reliever, either Cecil or someone to replace him, and then they also need to add at least one or two right-handers. And so if they can find a way to get Cecil locked up, there's no really alternative within the system to take over that primary lefty role. I think it would be a good move for them to do that, and 3 years might be a little bit longer than you'd normally want to go on a guy like Brett Cecil because of that inconsistency, but it's 3 years is probably what you're going to have to do to get it done. I mean, he's just had enough success over the years, and the market is high enough for relievers right now that a 3-year deal is just probably the minimum of what it would take to get a deal done.
One more question for you, Gregor. Obviously, the Blue Jays have already been busy this offseason, but we know that the winter meetings is when things really take off in general as far as the hot stove season comes. First week in December coming up outside of Washington, D.C. Generally, what is the, and I guess generally we would have to look back 1 year as opposed to a deeper history with the Blue Jays because of the newer front office. But what do you think Shapiro and Atkins, what's their approach when they head into a winter meetings?
I think they're going to continue to look for these kind of low risk, kind of medium sized reward type contracts, kind of the ones that you've seen Kendrys Morales sign with the Jays, similar to what the Toronto did last year with Jay Happ on that 3-year deal that worked out very well for them, but was heavily criticized at the time. I think those are the type of kind of mid-level free agents that they're going to target, guys who they can get on relatively short term. I don't think you're going to see this group right now make a really bold move and hand out a 5-6-year deal to a free agent, and I don't think you're going to see them make a major move in terms of adding a big name player that's going to cost a lot of prospect capital in return. I think they're going to try and use the resources they have at their disposal right now, and they have some money to spend, but I think they're going to kind of evenly distribute that throughout the roster as opposed to making a big splash like you would kind of see a team make wherever Edwin Encarnacion and maybe even a guy like Jose Bautista ends up this offseason.
All right, this has been MLB.com Extras, our Blue Jays edition for Gregor Chisholm. I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week. I'm talking Rays baseball, and the winner of the Fort C. Frick Award will be announced during the winter meetings in December. Dwayne, let's start. I want to talk a little bit about Bill Chastain because he's usually on this podcast with me covering the Rays. He's our MLB.com Rays reporter. And poor Bill, because the American League Cy Young Award vote on Wednesday night has kind of been under fire. He left Justin Verlander off of his ballot. When you look at his ballot, I think it's very fair. The American League Cy Young Award race this year was certainly wide open, from Zach Britton, a closer, being involved in it. None of the starters, to me, really jumped off the page as far as guys who should be a definite Cy Young Award winner. So he has five legitimate guys on there, not Justin Verlander. He was one of just two guys not to do that. And because of that, and Verlander obviously coming in second place, Bill has taken a little bit of slack on Twitter, but I don't think it's fair. What are your thoughts? You agree with me on that?
Yeah, it's the system. It's the way the system works. You can't argue, as you pointed out, with the selections that Bill made. Things don't always work out the way we would like them to work out, and for that reason, I'm now hiding Bill Chastain in my basement even as we speak.
I knew he had to be somewhere. Excellent. Good, and you're covering his spot here on the podcast. Tremendous.
All right, yes.
All
exactly.
Right. Let's get into some Rays baseball because, Dwayne, 2016 was just one of those seasons that kind of got off on the wrong foot, and then it just seemed like a team that at some point along the way needed to catch a break, and it seems like most teams at some point do. That never came for the Rays. They hit a lot of home runs, but other than that, everything kind of just went the other way. So I want to know, are you in the camp that with a few tweaks and a little luck, this team can contend again in 2017, or does this team need to make some drastic changes?
Well, I think first and foremost, they have to get back to the kind of team that made them successful, and that was built on pitching and supporting that pitching with good, solid defense. And every club, and certainly including this one, is looking for more offense. But I think one of the things that happened with this team last year, Chris Archer was not the Chris Archer in the first half that they had hoped that he would be and certainly had reason to expect that he would be based on prior years. And all of that started with command of the fastball and the challenge he had with that. So that was difficult in and of itself. You never have enough pitching. I think that was the case with this club last year. But the one thing that they also did not have was as good a defensive team as they had hoped they would have. And I think they made some miscalculations in two or three spots that they, as the season progressed, recognized and tried to address going forward. And I think they will do that. I do think that they feel There are some spots that need to be addressed. I think they're willing to seriously discuss moving a starting pitcher if they can leverage that to fill a couple of spots. And if they do that, then I think they're deep enough in pitching. Now, I know it's a dangerous statement to say and easy to say in the offseason because I guess no team is really deep enough. But I think they feel as if they are, that they can trade a starting pitcher, still have enough arms to cover the innings that you want from starting pitching. They like Colome in critical spots out of the bullpen, particularly late to close things out. And they've had a remarkable run of restructuring bullpens here as well. I think that will continue. But defense is a big deal for them. I think they were disappointed in the way that the Desmond Jennings saga turned out. They were hoping more out of him. And had that worked, and had he been healthy and been productive, I think we could have seen an interesting lineup where you'd have a guy who could give you good defense in the outfield, and they initially were hoping that he could hit fifth or sixth, somewhere in the middle of the lineup. But I think if they had a guy like that, say in left field, who could hit ninth and help turn the order over, I think that would be a major plus to make this team multifaceted offensively. And then if that player turns out to be a good defensive player, which he has to be in the outfield, then I think something like that can help this team be a maybe a surprise team in the East. But they're gonna. But I think that's the direction they're going to have to go in the offseason.
And you mentioned trading a starting pitcher, and the guy that would, I guess, likely bring back the most, and the guy that you're hearing rumors about already a lot, is Chris Archer. Obviously, this is a young guy. He's a charismatic guy. He's a guy that has shown at times that he can be a top-of-the-rotation type guy, although, as you mentioned, not so much last year. If they were to trade Archer this offseason, is it kind of maybe trading him when his stock is low?
Well, see, I think they have to take that into consideration, and I don't think it's a foregone conclusion, despite all of the rumor and talk that we hear now, that he would be the guy. I really think there's keen interest in Smiley. I think there are a number of teams. Texas was very high on him. So I think we'll hear a lot of conversation about Drew Smiley, and I think from the Rays' perspective, they'll entertain that kind of discussion.
Certainly. And the other rumor that's kind of surprised me is you're hearing Evan Longoria's name come up. And I guess part of that, Duane, is because you look at that contract he signed years ago when he kind of, with that contract, made himself Mr. Ray, in a sense. He committed to this organization, and that was a big thing when that happened, and this team was kind of just getting into the fact where they were going to be a contender year after year. You look at that contract now, though, in the year he's coming off, and it is a super team-friendly deal. So, obviously, no question teams would be interested in trading for him, but I question whether or not the Rays would seriously consider trading Longoria away.
Yeah, I do, too. I think the Rays have a couple of ways to look at that, and I think they have 2 years before they find themselves in a situation, or maybe a year, year and a half, leading up to 2 years. He's 2 years away from being a 5-10 guy. Well, I think they could have discussions somewhere between now and then about a deal, but any deal involving him, they have to be spot on with what they get back. And I think that's a major challenge. So I don't think it's an immediate concern. You know, nothing is ever impossible in this game. And as soon as we finish the interview, they could do something. But I don't know that it's imminent. But I think somewhere over the next two-year window, they will have to have some serious discussions with other clubs about him. But this team, I think, could keep him going forward. And with some of the tweaks, I'd love to have somebody on a corner outfield that we discussed. I think they'd love to have some catching help. Absolutely. I think overall they're pretty satisfied with how the infield is going to shape up. And I think if they could acquire a couple of pieces there to add to the core that they have. I think they feel that the team could be a pretty good team. And so why trade Evan Longoria when they feel they're on the cusp then of coming back and being competitive in the East? But I think somewhere over the next couple of years, there will be some serious discussion about that. Whether anything comes of that, we'll wait and see. But I absolutely would anticipate some talk about it.
One more question for you, Duane. Obviously, there's already been moves here in the offseason, but everything always really gets heated up at the winter meetings. Those are coming up early December down in Washington, D.C. What is generally the Rays' approach to the winter meetings and the craziness that can happen over 4 days?
What I've seen them do is carry out a lot of conversation. They like to test the market. They like to see what other clubs are willing to talk with them about. I don't know necessarily that I would expect that they would pull the trigger on deals. And again, you know, as we begin our great prognostications here, as soon as we think they'll do something, something else happens. But given history and the mindset of what I see the front office here, I think they're very methodical about that. They know that there's not necessarily any great hurry to do that. Clubs are always looking for pitching. I think they feel they can deal from that perspective and wait and make sure that they get the best in return that they can get for the pitching that they're willing to give up.
All right, great stuff. Great stuff, Duane. Thanks for joining us, and I almost said his name right there, and thanks for keeping Bill Chastain safe for us.
All right, Tim, my pleasure. And I've got some meatloaf that we're going to send down to the basement and keep Bill well-nourished.
All right. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Rays edition. For Duane Statz, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next time. Hey, everyone. Tim McMaster here along with our MLB.com Yankees reporter, Brian Hoke. And, Brian, it's awards week across Major League Baseball as far as the Baseball Writers of America awards. And the Rookie of the Year was the one spot where the Yankees had a chance. Obviously, Gary Sanchez's chances were based on a very small sample size, but he was so good that I think some people thought he might pull it out over Michael Fulmer. But in the end, Michael Fulmer is the American League Rookie of the Year. This certainly, though, doesn't take anything away from what Gary Sanchez did over 2 months of this Yankee season.
No, I mean, it's incredible that Sanchez was even in the discussion at the end. And I actually, Tim, was one of the writers who voted on this award, and I will can tell you I wrestled with it long and hard for a better part of a month there. Fulmer was obviously the favorite, but and Sanchez was going to have to do something fantastic to even make up the ground to be in consideration there. He was fantastic, and I really wrestled with it for a long time, but Sanchez, he won awards. He won Player of the Month, Rookie of the Month for August. He was recognized. And it was really close in the end, but when I did fill out my ballot, I went Fulmer 1, Sanchez 2, Tyler Naquin 3. That's generally how it turned out. So there was a lot of agreement with me. I think the writers did get it right, but even for Sanchez to be that close, that speaks volumes about what he was able to do in those 2 months. He kept the Yankees relevant toward the end of the season. Fantastic. This is not taking anything away from Gary Sanchez. It's just I wish I'd seen more of him. He's going to win plenty of awards coming up. I think that even to be recognized is it speaks volumes about his impact on the Yankees, not just for 2016, but for the future as well.
Yeah, and certainly one of many reasons to be excited about this team heading into 2017. Now it's the offseason, and you think back to a year ago, Brian, and this is a Yankees organization that went through an entire hot stove season and did not sign a free agent, which at the time was amazing, and looking back on it still seems like just an unbelievable thing for the New York Yankees. I'm assuming that's not going to be the case this year. The question is, how big do they go as far as free agency? If you had to kind of pick an area, is a possible return of Aroldis Chapman maybe the one thing that stands out as a big-ticket signing?
To me, it does. I know that the Yankees are already interested, and that was pretty much the worst-kept secret in the Bronx, that they were going to make an overture to Chapman and bring him back. He fit in well. After he served the suspension, he was no problem in the clubhouse. They liked having him. Obviously, Dellin Betances struggled down the stretch. You're not going to have Andrew Miller next year. So on both ends of the pitching side, rotation and bullpen. I think Brian Cashman is going to be active, but you look at the free agent market, and the bullpen is where he could make some moves. I think that you look at not just Chapman, but Kenley Jansen is out there, Mark Melanson is out there. You can contrast that with the starting pitching side, where Rich Hill is pretty much the biggest name on the market. And what that tells me is the Yankees, if they have free agent dollars to spend, they're going to spend it in the bullpen. They'll try to make a trade for a starting pitcher rather than throw a lot of money at a guy. Rich Hill, they had him a few years ago, and not in that role, but I think that's probably where they'll go. They do have some money coming off the books because Mark Teixeira retired. You traded away Carlos Beltran. Andrew Miller was traded away. Chapman was traded away. So they have some money to put back on the books. They're not going to go all in this offseason. I think that's a couple years down the line, but I think that they've got some money to spend. They're going to be players on the free agent market.
You mentioned Andrew Miller, and obviously you saw a lot of him in 2016, Brian. But then to see what he did during the postseason with the Indians, where, I mean, for a guy who wasn't even a closer to be the MVP of a league championship series is amazing. But he was amazing. Did he even surprise you? And you know how good he was all year, but with what he was able to do for extended time in games during the postseason?
I knew Miller was good. I didn't know he was that good. And I even told him that after the ALCS. I was in Toronto for the celebration there. And I mentioned to Miller in that celebration, in between the champagne and everything that was going on, I said, if I had told you in spring training that all this was going to happen when we were back in Tampa, what would you have thought? And he said, I don't think I would have ever believed that this was all possible. So the Indians knew what they were going to get with him. They knew that they were going to use him aggressively. Give Terry Francona credit for kind of bucking tradition and using him in unorthodox ways. I mean, you bring that guy in the fifth, sixth, seventh innings, he's going after the highest leverage outs, the biggest outs of the game, and those are not always in the eighth or ninth inning. So give Terry Francona credit. Give the Indians credit for having the courage to do it. I don't think you could do that over the course of 162 games, but once you get in October, everything's on the table there. So I think it was very smart the way they used Andrew Miller. It takes a special kind of pitcher to do it, and he is that special kind of pitcher.
You mentioned the possibility of making some trades to maybe bring in pitching. When you look at tradable pieces on this Yankees team, obviously we mentioned how good Gary Sanchez was, and that makes you think that Brian McCann is possibly a guy that could be traded, although he still fits into that DH role and a part-time catcher as well. Brett Gardner is always the name, Brian. Is that name going to be swirling around the rumor mill again this entire hot stove?
I think you're going to hear them both. I think that either one of those guys being moved would be the opening where they could go after conceivably a guy like a Cespedes or a Jose Bautista or Edwin Encarnacion. I think that if they are going to go after a big bat, you got to move one of those other pieces first, because otherwise there's kind of roadblocks all around that lineup. So I think that Gardner has a very reasonable contract and should draw interest. We heard that all last offseason. McCann now has a very reasonable contract. He wasn't a piece that they could have moved last offseason because they needed a catcher. Suddenly Sanchez is their guy. So they're in a very much the same position as they were last year. And what you heard was, sure, they would entertain trading Brett Gardner, but they didn't necessarily have to do it. And they're in that situation now with McCann. I think that it's not the worst thing in the world to have McCann catching a couple days a week. He would be your DH, that big left-handed bat at Yankee Stadium. That's not the worst thing in the world. They could get by with that. But if they can improve upon it, and really, if they can cash him in and get the kind of prospect haul that they did in July when they moved guys like Chapman, Miller, Beltran, that's what I think they're going to hold on for. They know, you look at the free agent catching market, there's not a whole lot out there. And I think that teams know that. They know what Brian McCann will be a ready-made fit to plug in behind the plate for 100, 110 games a year. There's value there for sure. And I think that the Yankees are not in a position where they're going to try and give either one of those players away.
Yeah, you have Matt Wieters out there. You have Wilson Ramos, but he's now injured, and who knows if he'll really be able to catch in 2017 with the ACL. And then I guess Jason Castro available. But like you said, there's not a ton of guys out there. One more thing I wanted to touch on with you. When you talk about the trades this team made at the deadline and that Aroldis Chapman deal, Gleyber Torres has been named Arizona Fall League Player of the Week. He got that distinction on Tuesday, second time this fall that he's gotten that award. The 19-year-old hit 600 for the week. He had a double, a triple, a couple RBIs. He's actually leading the AFL in average with hitting 382. His OBP, Brian, is 500. I mean, He's 19 years old. He's got to be one of the absolute youngest players in the Arizona Fall League, and he is making that trade look even better right now, especially with the thought that there's a chance Chapman could be back in pinstripes.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think the Cubs are going to be in a position here where they're going to complain about anything after ending that World Series.
No, certainly.
But Torres, he's a player. This guy is on the come, and I think you're seeing why the Yankees insisted upon him to move Chapman. I think that you're right. He is the youngest player in the Arizona Fall League. That makes it all the more impressive. And this is a guy that the Yankees are extremely high on, and for good reason. I think that you're going to see him this year at Double-A Trenton. Beyond that, I mean, this is a fast track to the big leagues. I think that you're going to see a guy here where the Yankees can conceivably look a year or two down the road and say, we could plug this guy into the lineup and he can be an everyday player. So you just hope he stays healthy, but the tools are all there. I think it's a very exciting young talent. I think it's impressive that what he's already been able to do in his young career, and I think he's got a lot of great things to come. But obviously one of the highest prospects in the Yankee organization for a reason, and there was a reason that they insisted upon getting him if they were going to give up Chapman in Chicago.
All right, Brian, this has been MLB.com Extras, our Yankees edition. For Brian Hoke, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week. Hey, everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Orioles reporter, Brittany Giroli. And, Brittany, already a busy offseason kind of for the Baltimore Orioles. Obviously, Mark Trumbo was a guy, one of 10 players that got qualifying offers from their teams. That deadline was Monday, and Trumbo, not a surprise, he turns down the qualifying offer. So he turns down basically a $17.2 million deal for 1 year with the Orioles. Instead, he'll be a free agent. We're also going to get a little bit into awards week with Buck Showalter and the Manager of the Year Award and stuff like that. But let's start with Trumbo. He was the Players' Choice Award for American League Comeback Player of the Year. Such a big season for the Orioles and really such a bargain for the Orioles. What are the chances that they can still bring Trumbo back in 2017?
They're okay. They're not great. I think Trumbo had such a good year, obviously such a good pickup for them, that it's going to cost them if they want to keep him. And keep in mind, they're a year removed from spending a whole lot of money last winter, including a lot of money on the power bat of Chris Davis. So I think they would like to keep him. I think they're going to remain in the mix for him. It's just going to depend on how much money he commands and what ownership is comfortable giving to him. So I know in a perfect world, they'd like to DH him a little bit more. So then you have to ask yourself, how much is he going to be worth coming off of that career year? His value is never going to be higher. You got to be careful you don't get into a situation where you're overpaying. But certainly he's high on their radar. They would like to have him back. At the end of the day, though, Tim, I don't know if it actually happens or not.
A year ago with Chris Davis, that just they waited and they waited and they waited, and it went on and on throughout. Really took over the entire offseason as far as the Orioles are concerned. If they don't bring back Mark Trumbo, they're going to have to get somebody else. So I would think this is something that needs to be decided a lot sooner than Chris Davis' situation figured itself out a year ago.
Yeah, you would think so. You would hope so, because it really has the tendency to kind of ruin your winter, just sitting around waiting. A lot of GMs, I was at the GM meetings last week, kind of talked about wanting to know at least where some of these free agents stand, because you don't want to get caught waiting around. And then here it is, spring training around the corner, and you haven't made any moves because the one guy you were waiting on didn't pan out. So they would definitely like to resolve this and not have it happen as Chris Davis did last year.
If Trumbo does go elsewhere, what are some other names that could kind of fit that role as far as playing a little bit of outfield, also being able to DH and just add some more pop in the middle of that lineup?
I don't know if you're going to be able to replace what Mark Trumbo's done on the free agent market, and that's partially why he's going to be such a coveted guy. I do know that they're prioritizing their outfield, getting some corner outfield guys, getting some better defensive guys to go alongside center fielder Adam Jones. And to that end, you can kind of look at the outfield market. Guys like Dexter Fowler could potentially be a really good fit. They'd like to get a left-handed hitting outfielder, if possible, at least one, maybe two. So I don't know if there's a guy out there who you can say, oh, we're not going to get Mark Trumbo, let's get X player. I think if they don't get him, they're going to have to look at run prevention instead of run production and get guys who defensively are going to help this team save runs and hope that the pitching staff can take a step forward as well.
And that makes a lot of sense, I think, for this team, because it's a team that's still going to have lots of power in that lineup, even without Trumbo. But the one of the kind of glaring things with the team last year was obviously that outfield defense. So that's obviously a chance to upgrade your team, make your team better without adding that bat. So certainly, and maybe a less expensive route to go as well. Well, Buck Showalter, a finalist for Manager of the Year in the AL. He doesn't win the award, Brittany, but he did such a great job in 2016 when he think about the starting rotation that really only worked itself out late in the year. There were so many kind of question marks and moving parts all season long. He dealt with that. As always, he did a great job with the bullpen. That's really kind of always been one of his strengths. Can you just sum up what made Showalter so good in 2016 from your standpoint, seeing him day in, day out?
Yeah, I think you kind of touched on it a little bit briefly there, but certainly they were picked to finish last by pretty much everyone going into spring training. They had no business competing. Not only did they compete, they started April on that historic run the first week of the season, and they rode that to a first-place finish for a good chunk of the first half. And while they did slow down in the second half, and Buck obviously made a questionable call about Zach Britton not using him in a wild card game, you could make the case that they wouldn't even have been there if not for Showalter. Again, did a really good job masterfully kind of maneuvering that roster around, was able to rely on that bullpen because the starters only went 4 and 5 innings a lot of the time. And he just never bought into the fact that they were supposed to be bad. And I think that's huge. He really sets the mindset, and it kind of goes from the top down there. And he's changed the culture a lot since coming here, very similar to what he did in 2014 when he won the Manager of the Year award. He exceeded expectations. They didn't get there. They didn't have quite the talent, in my opinion, that they did in 14, but still a very, very good job for a team that, again, wasn't supposed to do anything but be in the basement.
You mentioned Zach Britton, and obviously he was a no-brainer as far as the Mariano Rivera Award goes, best reliever in the American League. He did not make it as far as a finalist for the Cy Young Award. I think a lot of people thought he would at least be included as far as that final three goes. At the end of the day, there's still that reliever versus starter thing, and three starters end up being the finalists, but still a great season for Zach Britton. More pitching, Brittany, when you look at this coaching staff, Dave Wallace decides to retire after 3 years in Baltimore, so that's now an opening for this team. Is that search very much underway, and is it kind of coming into focus as far as who are possibilities to fill that role as the Orioles pitching coach?
A little bit. I do know that when I spoke with Buck Showalter last week, he was in Baltimore kind of interviewing guys, vetting that process. What makes it more difficult, Tim, is that Dom Chidi, their bullpen coach, also left. And he was a guy that, you know, people really liked, really paired well with Dave Wallace, and they felt like maybe at first they would just promote him. But he left, took a job with the Braves organization, so they really have to start fresh here. And I asked Dan Duquette how worrisome is it? Because you still have a decent amount of young pitchers. And he said they feel like they're okay, that Dave Wallace and Dom Chidi were kind of able to guide some of their younger guys like Gauffman and Bundy through some trouble. And they feel like they've got some veteran leadership there in that pitching staff, that this won't negatively affect them as much as maybe a year or two ago it would have. I do think that they're going to bring in a nice mix of external and internal candidates they've kind of been talking about. They like being able to keep things in the organization if possible, but they're also cognizant of the fact that Buck always says robbing Peter to pay Paul. You don't want to take a guy from, say, AAA or somewhere else in your organization and then have that hole there. So they're going to do a very careful job vetting these guys. Buck has been through a bunch of different pitching coaches since he's been here. I would imagine that they'd like to get this done before the end of the month and really kind of focus instead on what they're going to do roster-wise, but obviously a big blow for the Orioles. I think people don't realize how much of an impact those two guys had on all the pitchers, not just the rotation guys. Zach Britton has talked about how important they've been, Brad Brock. These guys have really praised Dom Chidi and Dave Wallace with their development.
And usually when you're replacing a pitching coach, it's because maybe pitching had gone the wrong way and you didn't like what the guy was doing and you end up firing him and looking for a replacement. This different in the sense that everyone liked Wallace. He did a great job and he just retires. So you're replacing a guy that everybody loved. All right. Great stuff as always, Brittany. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Orioles edition. For Brittany Giroli, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week. Hey everyone, Tim McMaster here, along with our MLB.com Red Sox reporter, Ian Brown. Ian, the offseason is here, the World Series behind us, obviously. It's nice to get back to doing these podcasts with you. So far, a couple of weeks technically, officially into the offseason, I guess. How's everything going in Boston, around the Red Sox fans, around Red Sox Nation?
Well, all is pretty quiet right now. People are, I think, recovered from the disappointing playoff loss and ready to see, you know, what this team is going to do to take another step forward next year.
Obviously, you look at the needs of this team, and David Ortiz is no longer a Red Sox, which is amazing for the how long he was. But that's a big bat, and maybe a bigger bat because of how good he was in his final season in Boston. Is that number one on the list to add a bat to help fill that role of DH or big bat middle of the lineup?
Yeah, I think so. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be a DH because, look, you could rotate different guys. You know, the Red Sox are one of the rare teams that's had one DH since 2003. A lot of people kind of mix it up at that position. So you do need to try to replace at least some of his production. You're not going to replace all of his production with one player. But this guy led the major leagues in OPS last year. So, yeah, I think Carlos Beltran is a guy that makes a lot of sense. You know, he's a very professional hitter, switch hitter. He's 40 years old. He can DH at this point of his career. So he would make the most sense, but I think they're going to exhaust all avenues. But I think the one thing, they really want a left-handed bat here because, look, they already have Xander Bogaerts, Mookie Betts, and Hanley Ramirez from the right side. So I think that they're lacking some power from the left side with David gone. So I think that most likely you'll see them try to get another left-handed bat to fill that void.
So a guy like Edwin Encarnacion, less likely, or that, you know, a big cost guy like that?
Yeah, no, I don't think that Encarnacion, with the money it's going to take to get him, I'm not sure they're going to go down that road and sign him for a 3 or 4 year deal at the age of 34. I think they might, like I said, just they feel reasonably good about their lineup. I mean, David is the one big loss. You have everybody else back, and you get Pablo Sandoval back too. So you're hoping to sort of replace that production collectively rather than one guy doing it. So I'd be surprised if they went out and got an Encarnacion or a Mark Trumbo or somebody like that.
It's obviously a thin market as far as starting pitching goes. Luckily, the Red Sox do have a good number of starting pitchers. Whether it's the right guys, we'll obviously see, but they have a solid six guys you can look at and point to and say these guys, any five of these six, could fill out a rotation easily. Bullpen, though, there's some work to be done. Obviously, Koji Uehara has been such a big part of this team. Junichi Tozawa, Brad Ziegler was a key addition. There's replacements that have to be gone out and found. They have their closer, which is good. At some point, you're going to get Carson back, so that's good as well. But how many guys would this team like to add to that bullpen?
Yeah, interesting. You know, they are going to lose three guys, as you mentioned there, likely with Koji, Brad Ziegler, and Junichi Tozawa. I don't necessarily expect them to restart any of those three guys just from the way Dave Dombrowski was talking about it. So, but surprisingly, he said he's really only looking to go out and get one guy because he feels like he has enough internally with the emergence of Joe Kelly, with Heath Hembree, the way he came on last year, Matt Barnes, they think he's going to take another step forward. And they have six starters for five spots, so that leaves another reliever. So I think that they're really looking to go out and get one impact guy. One guy that could be interesting is a former closer in Greg Holland, who's coming off the injury, obviously. He's been throwing for teams. And, you know, that could be a guy that they go out and sign. So it'll be interesting to see what they do. But it sounds like Dombrowski looking to really make one significant addition to the bullpen here.
Mentioned the closer back, obviously, with Craig Kimbrell. And you look at what closers are going to be going for this offseason. I think we're going to see some record-setting deals, Aroldis Chapman, Kenley Jansen, and Mark Melancon, three big-time closers that are available. And the cost that it's going to take to get one of those guys, it kind of makes David Dombrowski's decision to make that trade for Kimbrell a year ago look that much smarter. Now, Kimbrell wasn't fantastic from day one through the end of the season. There was obviously some ups and downs, and I think most people would expect him to be probably better in 2017. But just the fact that they have that guy ready to go, locked in at what's now a reasonable price.
Yeah, no, I think they feel good about that. I'm sure that when they made that move, they were looking at kind of the future of closers, you know, looking ahead the next couple of years. And now you have, you not only got last season out of Craig Kimbrell, but you have him this season. You know, then you have him for an option in 2018. So I think that they like that deal a lot right now. And, you know, I think that, yeah, you know, you're right. These guys are going to make a ton of money, whether it's Jansen, Chapman, or Melanson. It's going to be a very high market for these guys. And, you know, I think they have to feel pretty good. They have to feel pretty good about their bullpen if, like I said, they can just go out and get maybe that one guy who can sort of solidify the eighth inning and work it along with those other guys.
It's awards week across baseball, the Baseball Writers Association Awards, and the Red Sox have Mookie Betts, a possible MVP candidate. That's on Thursday. Rick Porcello in the Cy Young race in the American League on Wednesday. Let's start with Porcello. We'll go according to time on Wednesday. Now, what are his chances? He won the Players' Choice Award. That's usually a pretty good indicator. Is he the front runner, do you think, heading into the announcement on Wednesday of AL Cy Young winner?
Yeah, boy, it's so hard to tell. If he is a front runner, it's maybe by a percentage point ahead of, you know, maybe you say it's a 51% chance of winning, you know, or less than that because you have three guys. But, you know, obviously, I think Justin Verlander had a great year also, and Kluber for that matter. Porcello, the one thing he has over the three guys, he was the most consistent of the three. He was really amazingly slump-free his entire season. He had one start where he gave up five runs. His worst start after that, he gave up four runs. I think it was four times. Other than that, three earned runs or less in every start. And just impressive across the board, great control. Doesn't have the strikeout numbers that Verlander and Kluber have, so it's going to be interesting to see the way this all plays out in the vote. But yeah, I think maybe Porcello, a slight favorite right now, but not by much. This, to me, is a really fascinating race in which nobody really separated himself from the pack. Just a bunch of guys who had really good years, but I don't think you had that Pedro Martinez 1999 season or one of those years Kershaw had the last few years.
And then Betts, already the Gold Glove, the Silver Slugger. What a season it was for Mookie Betts. The other guy that it feels like it's going to come down to Betts or Trout. And obviously yeah. Trout was a great player, as he always is, on a bad team. Betts was a player on a team that won its division. That could be a separator. What do you think the deciding factor is in this AL MVP race?
Yeah, Tim, I really think Betts is going to win because, you know, to me, the guys, when it's a guy from a, you know, a non-contending team that wins the MVP, the guy is usually a guy that just has like an unbelievable year. Like I think that year that A-Rod had in Texas that one time, where it's just like, you know, almost like a transcendent type of season. Where in this case, I think Betts and Trout are pretty equal in a lot of their numbers. I think Betts was actually better defensively if you look at the metrics, and he played for an American League East champion. Altuve obviously had a very good year too, but I think the fact that Betts is the only one of the three AL MVP finalists that played in the playoffs, I think that could give him the very slight edge. It could make him the MVP on Thursday.
The Red Sox quickly took care of a hole they had to replace with Torey Lovullo leaving the team to get that manager job. He hung in there an extra year, I think, where a lot of people thought he may be getting that managerial job a year ago. Gary DeSarcina is the new bench coach of the Red Sox. Here's a guy who's familiar with the organization. He's from Massachusetts. He managed Pawtucket, I know, in 2013. I think he managed the Lowell Spinners at one point before that. He's from Billerica, Mass, Ian, which is my high school's arch rival, Chelmsford-Billerica, as we get close to the big Thanksgiving Day football game. But he's a guy that I think grew up a Red Sox fan, and now he kind of returns to the Major League club. What have your first thoughts been on that hire as the new bench coach?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I think it's fascinating the way life works sometimes. So you look at Torey Lovullo and the fact that, like you said, a lot of people thought he could be a manager a year ago. And, you know, a really selfless act, he decided to stay on another year to help John Farrell out if John Farrell is coming back from cancer. And, you know, they just wanted to make sure. He didn't know 100% that John was going to come back and have no health limitations. He didn't know if John was going to maybe get fatigued at some point. It turns out that John, fortunately, was in great health. And Lavella was just there kind of filling the bench coach role as always. But now you look at it, and he gets to go manage with, you know, one of the people he's closest to in baseball, Mike Hayes. And this was an opportunity that he wouldn't have had if he had left to fill another vacancy a year ago. So first of all, couldn't have worked out any better for Lavello. And second of all, I think that DeSarcina is really the perfect fit. This is a guy who's familiar with the organization. He's kind of like-minded with, you know, John Farrell. He played with John Farrell with the Angels in the early 90s. And he has an impressive background when you look at all the different things he's done in baseball. So I think Gary DeSarcina really a very good fit. This is the next natural step in his progression on his ladder to hopefully maybe one day become a manager himself. So I really like the hire of Gary DeSarcina for the Red Sox.
All right, great stuff, Ian. It's going to be an interesting offseason. This has been MLB.com Extras, our Red Sox edition. For Ian Brown, I'm Tim McMaster. Tune in again next week.
MLB.tv Premium, the number one live streaming sports service, is celebrating 13 years. Watch every out-of-market regular season game live or on demand in true HD. Real-time highlights, live look-ins, pitch tracking widget, and more. MLB.tv Premium includes a free At-Bat 15 subscription. Watch live baseball on over 400 mobile and connected devices. Watch at home, in the office, or on the go. Every night, on every device. Blackout and other restrictions apply. Visit MLB.tv for details.